This is 24-hour KLRB FM Carmel. And this is part two of Dialogue Conspiracy with research specialist Mae Brussel. And if you have just joined us on the half hour, I don't know if I could have
the energy to run through what Dialogue Conspiracy is again.
You'll have to listen.
I don't know
if
anybody has the patience to hear it again. But Dialogue Conspiracy talks about political happenings in the news. It started 10 years ago with research by Mae into the assassination of John Kennedy, and it's been going full blast ever since. And a lot of people have been exposed to those ideas, and we hope if you are listening for the first time today that you will take them for what they are presented as, information for you to consider making your decisions about what's happening in the world. So with that, let's get back to Andrew Topping and the plot to assassinate Richard Nixon.
Yes, we're talking, the first half hour we talked about the plans to kill Nixon this year in 1972. Incidentally, we'll go back to Topping, but I have spoken so many times on these shows about that particular plan to kill Richard Nixon and the ways he could be killed or who would want to kill him. And you know, years ago, if you ever said one word on the radio or telephone or wrote a letter to this effect, the Secret Service came to you and said, what's the source of information? What do you know? What is true? You know, and they would check everything out if you just even breathed the word. But I can go on the air every week, and this is almost proof to me, one of the proofs that nobody ever in the Secret Service high up would dare want to know, because if they had that information and it turned out later, if anyone, the Secret Service was in on that thing, which they were on the killing of Robert Kennedy and also John Kennedy, if they knew it, then they'd be responsible to act on the information. And I think it just stays at this level between you and me, and the Secret Service has never approached me and wanted to know who would kill Nixon and why and investigated it. So that's an interesting point. We're back to Andrew Topping and two articles in the paper this last Monday on a plan to kill Richard Nixon. And I'm bringing out certain points on why I don't think it should be taken lightly. And mostly what I'm doing is asking a lot of questions that are never going to be answered in Topping's court trial unless we keep them in our mind and write to public officials and read articles about this subject that I want to write on. Now, Andrew Topping had told neighbors, he said, he was always talking about a fantastic deal that's going somewhere that never seemed to come through. Now that's in keeping with Arthur Bramer, not Bramer so much, but before the Kennedy assassination, a girl told somebody in front of the Ambassador Hotel that they hang around, something big is gonna take place. In Miami, Bernard Barker, man arrested at the Watergate Hotel, was telling fellow friends down in Miami, something big is going to happen at the time of the conventions. I cross-filed this under foreknowledge of assassinations because there were many people at the time of the John Kennedy murder who were talking about something was going to take place and Kennedy was going to get it. Somebody out at Knott's Berry Farm knew about it. There were a whole lot of people who knew about that something was going to happen. Well, this particular man, Topping, was saying to Lillian Stevens, a neighbor, hang around. He says something fantastic is going to happen. But she said that he seemed like a long time away, like it was never going to come through. Well, these assassination attempts take from 1 year to a year and a half from the time that people really get involved. Now, Mrs. Stevens also said he was very friendly, but there were strange things going on in that apartment, men coming and going late at night. And
sounds like something Martha Mitchell said.
Things going on.
And men coming in. Well, she talked about men that were involved at one time, didn't she?
Well, she was kept down by five men. She didn't complain so much, but a landlady in New Orleans, Mrs. Garner, was interviewed by the Warren Commission, and they asked about Lee Harvey Oswald and the apartment and where he lived, and she says, well, all night there were people coming and going in meetings at night. You know, in the daytime it was quiet, but meetings at night. And Bramer's mother said she'd go to his apartment, he wouldn't let her in, that there were people there all the time, but she couldn't get in to see them.
Sounds suspicious.
Yeah, well, she says there were always strange things going on in the apartment lately, you know, men coming and going late at night. Now, he changed his appearance, she says. He was always unshaven. See, he used to be at Wall Street, and he was self-employed, a broker. But in the last few months, he became a ragamuffin, and he was always unshaven. Now, this is sort of like the contact man to the guy who's going to be hired has to lose his Wall Street image, and, you know, to lose the cutoff there, he's not going to go around like looking like an FBI man with a dark suit and short hair. And every one of these people takes on this look like the second Oswald in New Orleans, had grew a beard and stubby beard and became unkempt, where Oswald was meticulous. And all of the contact people take on this semi, even Bramer sort of grew a beard and his hair got frowsy, you know, when he was
being tried in court. He didn't have that appearance before. He was an all-American boy, but he takes on this scrubby look. But this Wall Street broker was becoming unshaven and becoming like a ragamuffin, which wasn't his usual appearance. Now, the wife of this man died 6 weeks ago, and he blamed the murder on political forces. He drapes his child's bed. The wife died 2 days after their baby was born, and he has an American flag draped over the crib. And he blames his wife's death on pro-rightist forces. He is extremely right-wing. When they say he's a radical right, that means he's not an ordinary Republican, even to the newsman's coverage. But he's blaming his team for killing his wife. He says they did it. He said it was beyond his control. Now, Martha Mitchell was taken a prisoner 6 weeks ago, where she was injected with fluid, taken away. No one has seen her. She said she saw dirty things. She saw dirty acts. She's locked up. Her husband resigned from the committee to reelect Richard Nixon. No one to this date knows where she is. She's disappeared for a month, given up their apartment in Washington. She was going to stay there longer. They gave it up, and now supposedly, I guess she's in New York. It hasn't surfaced or been seen since she said she was a prisoner. And in the article I did for The Realist, which we'll take time out to give you the address for in a few minutes, I mentioned the fact that the fascist state was handling Martha in the only way they could if she saw dirty things. And I implied what really could happen to her, and I'm sure if she weren't the wife of John Mitchell, she could have been murdered for the things that she saw, because this was a very important process that was taking place. If my theories or information are correct, it was very important. And Martha is isolated and a prisoner, and John has resigned. But the wife of the man in New York died, and he says she died through forces beyond his control by pro-rightist forces. Means his own team. And I interpret the flag over the crib as being that as somewhat guilt, like she died in the service of the country, like she, maybe she saw something had to be killed. And, you know, there's kind of a draping this crib after the mother dies by the same political team that he's working with. So I'm wondering what pro-rightist forces killed her. At the time that she was killed, we'll go into his weapons and so forth, he was picked up for having illegal weapons in his home, and she was killed by one of those guns that still was loaded at the time of his arrest when he was hiring someone to kill Nixon. He was apprehended for that and got off, and he was home still with the same loaded gun. Now, his plans for the assassination, we'll go back to that, but I'm taking each sentence in the article as it read and discussing it with you. The plans for the assassination, he said, would be early next week, around which, if he serviced on the 12th, that would make it August 19th or later. It would be between the Republican convention and the inauguration. Now, this is the time period that Tackwood said martial law would be created at the time of the convention, and then Nixon would be killed. Well, there will not be martial law at the time of the Miami conventions. I think that's blown up. I don't think there'll be as many killings now. And I think there'll be more peace and quiet in Miami because four of the men at the Watergate are locked up and the others have fled and the money is tied up. So we're going to save a lot of blood and violence. And now another man involved in killing that could have been part of that link is locked up. He's got $500,000 bail. And the judge said, considering the seriousness of the charge, the judge didn't take the circumstances of Mr. Topping lightly. Luckily, he didn't take it as a fluke, you see. His links are too important. They're just, I know that they must have more information back there, or they have an inkling that this was possible, and he's not going to be out on any chance. Now, this is the way he was caught. He had requested to see Richard Nixon, and a man was interviewed who's a good friend of his, and he claimed to know Topping. And when the Secret Service said, what kind of a man is Topping? Because they must take the credibility of this man as a witness, because the man is about to see the President of the United States. He said, I have to tell you that he has tried to enlist help in finding someone to kill the president, that he's in on the plan to kill the president. This came out through a routine interview of a friend who said that Topping was involved in wanting to kill the president. Now, I have certain questions on that statement that he made. What date did he start getting help to kill the president? You see, was he just arrested on his last fluke, or has he been involved in a long-range plan? You see, because the Watergate was moved from San Diego, not the Watergate, the Squad 19 was moved from San Diego to Miami. So a New York team may have been used. Maybe he didn't think a thing about killing the president. Someone from California would have done it if it was on the West Coast.
And maybe a whole new team was caught in there. So at what time did he decide that he'd be part of killing the president back there? And did they have to arrest this cutoff man? Is Andrew Topping the cutoff between very high people like James McWhorter, Howard Hunt, and the gunman? Did they have to squeal on their own, just like his wife was killed? Did they have to take him at this time because of linking it to the Watergate story? New York was always involved in this in a way, with the Brammer and with the men arrested at the Watergate. And did they have to take this cutoff man, and is he going to take the rap? Just like the five men arrested in Washington are going to take the rap for people higher up. They were doing an assignment. They were paid. They received their money from other sources. They weren't taking their own investment and bugging the Watergate. But who hired them is going to be protected. And the five men are going to get the rap. See, they're going to try to limit it to the five and not the others who have resigned. Now, he was arrested.
Has he named names?
Andrew Topping? No. If you work for the agency, you
don't know names?
No. I read a report of a soldier from My Lai who testified at the trial when it was taking place. And I have a copy of a letter he wrote that he believed so much in the American Army and the reputation of America that he would lie. He would give his life. He would lie and sign papers that weren't true if his country wanted him to. He calls that patriotism, you know, in defense of the killings in Vietnam. He would lie if he had to. If you're working for an agency, whether it's the KGB or the MVD in Russia or the CIA or FBI, you have an assignment and you don't squeal. You're into that. You know the responsibilities when you get into it, and no one mentions the guy upstairs. If he had to be stopped now, he's not mentioning the names. Now, the reason they found him was on July 6th, his wife died of gunshot wounds. The water break thing was June the 19th, that Martha Mitchell was taken prisoner about the 23rd, and then she was flown to Rye, New York. But shortly after that, 1 week later, this man's wife died. And her death was declared a suicide with a question mark, but the authorities went into the apartment. And he was charged at that time with having unregistered weapons. And he was reprimanded and arrested for possessing unregistered weapons. But at the time of his arrest for hiring, paying money for someone as a down payment to kill Nixon next week, he still had unregistered weapons. The same gun that killed his wife was loaded in his apartment this time. He still had it. Now,
is it normal procedure to confiscate them?
Well, why bother to arrest them if you can still keep them?
Well, I don't know. That's why I'm asking. I mean, should they have been picked up?
Logically,
it seems that they would. I'm not being familiar with New York police procedure. I don't know whether they tell a guy that they arrest him and tell him to go out and register it, or whether they take him and say, you know, you're not supposed to have weapons or what. If the police normally confiscate it and he had it in his apartment, that does look...
It stinks to high heaven.
Yeah.
Well, the article I read,
bit.
He still had the same weapon at the time of his arrest, and it was loaded. Now, I think the thing really stinks, you know, that he still has it.
It'd be interesting to know if somebody, one of the researchers back in New York, can check on what what the procedure is in New York for that type of thing, whether they do confiscate the weapons.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a lot of questions that I'm posing here, and that the people in New York, you know, should get into this, and I'll make a list of all these questions and try to get it off to people back there and put it in their hands, you know, in the form of an article, because I think it's very important. It's important because even though he was stopped, it means there's another one 5 weeks away or 6 weeks away, see, who isn't related to the past cutoffs. So it'll happen because their mind is set for it to happen. Or else they could take McGovern one more time and keep the phony elections going, you know. But anyway, he described himself, as I said before, as an investment dealer. And a big clue to Andrew Topping and how he gets these weapons or keeps them or is who does he know in the investment market? Who are his clients? I think they should be named if he's above board and so forth, or if he's even part of a extreme right wing that wants to kill the president of the United States, we should know who his clients are to see if there are any links to the other people mentioned coming out in the news now, you know. Now, he's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. We're in a different echelon here because when I talk about political assassinations, we talk about the FBI or Richard Helms or J. Edgar Hoover, and then we talk about the hired patsies like Sirhan and James Ray or Oswald. But the man I'm talking about now, Andrew Topping, is somebody I've never been able to pin yet on any of my shows or talk about publicly, and that's the next echelon between the high man and the gunman. This echelon was broken in the case of Yablonsky, in the killing of Yablonsky, where the men that were caught in defense named the next layer, and it goes all the way up to the top of the mine workers, but they got Tony Boyle on some other charge, not murder of Yablonsky. They've got him for 5 years on another charge, but it took another echelon of people in the mine workers union and above the hired employee, and they fingered him. Well, in this case, we have a college graduate, a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, who recently, this is the newspaper article, is taking graduate courses at Columbia University. Now, that's an interesting point because just this week, Joe Justine from Germany sent out a newsletter, and for those of you who listen to past shows, you know the name. He's written 8 books on political assassinations. He's been a writer for 40 years. Lives in Germany, studies political assassinations and coup d'etat, studied the rise of Hitler, left Germany when Hitler came to power, came back later, and caught on to the political murder of John Kennedy quickly because of the similarities of the rise to Hitler. And he has a newsletter that comes out of Germany every 2 weeks, and this one is dated August the 1st, and it's about Columbia University and their ties with the secret government. Now, Mr. Topping has been taking graduate courses at Columbia. That is not important in itself. It's only important what courses did he take or what professors, because Joe Justine's letter says, Columbia's ties, this is in quotes, with the secret government are so extensive that the university has actually both an overt and a covert national security apparatus on their campus. The overt is the School of International Affairs, where Dean Andrew Cordier came from the UN Secretariat with an interesting history. In 1963, he used his UN post to make possible the successful CIA-backed coup against Patrice Lumumba. You know, I've said how the CIA killed Lumumba. The involvement of the CIA and Columbia University and the Rockefeller interests in Africa goes even deeper. And shortly after coming to Columbia, Dean Cordier established an African studies program, a special division of the School of International Affairs. They research America's Cold War hotspots. Director of Columbia's African program is Professor Gray Cohen, a key figure who once received 90% of his findings or his funding for his studies from CIA fronts. He said the studies in Columbia University are linked to the CIA operations in Africa. And they make Columbia secret agent number one among the competing universities. There's a quotation from Washington Post when the students had a protest in Columbia in 1968, calling Mr. Cordier the assassin for the CIA. And I'm reading certain quotations from the newsletter this week. He has references to Columbia University and certain departments. So the important thing is, I'm not saying Andrew Topping is related to the CIA departments that overthrew countries in Africa or work with the United States government, where they get 85 or 95% of the funding in those departments from the CIA. But I think because he had contacts to see the president, and he's an important man, a graduate from Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania, graduate school, and he's currently going to Columbia University. You know, his wife, he's a stockbroker. We don't know who he represents. And he's going to Columbia right now. Is it a conduit of funds? It has been all the time up to now. So you have to go into the question of what courses was he studying at Columbia University? Now, what was he like? Andrew Topping was described as a right-wing radical. Now, this, again, is a different echelon we have, because Oswald was in Navy intelligence, and they said he was a communist, and Sirhan messed around with the racetrack groups in the underworld, and they tried to say he killed Robert Kennedy for avenging the Arab interests in Israel. And James Ray was put on to the public, the outside public, as a drifter and no good ex-criminal. His brother is manager for Stoner's States Rights Party, and Ray is involved with extreme right-wingers. His brother visits him all the time. He's not out of the political scene. And the echelon, the patsies, are given a description in the media of one kind of person. But what are the people like who hire them? Right-wing radicals. They said that his motive was that he was an extreme right-wing, he's pro-war. The police felt that he was very radical. Well, I've read many, many articles about the extreme right-wing in this country, represented by Ashbrook and Buckley and the Agnew people, the Young Americans for Freedom, that Nixon is soft on China, soft on Cuba, beginning trade with Russia, that he's let them down. The Vietnam story, and he's let them down. There's a group that think he's a communist, according to what he was formerly and what he promised to be. Now, the income of Mr. Topping is secret. He appeared very well off. He seemed unemployed. This was the statement. Not only was he self-employed, but he seemed unemployed. He was meeting with a lot of people at night. He seemed unemployed. He hired a private detective for undisclosed purposes, and he was home writing all the time. Now, Howard Hunt, the contact man, that Mr. White, wrote 40 books for the CIA. He was a writer, too. And this man was writing books to sell to the government on combat, and in American combat and hand-to-hand combat. Question, what branch of the service did he work for that he had experience to write books on hand-to-hand combat? And did he have a contract already with the government? Was he employed in a form that they'd use his books? He was writing books on the government. He was going to see Nixon. He had to have battle experience. So question, was he in intelligence work? What was he doing in the service that he learned to write about combat? Where did he get his combat experience? Living in a high-rise in New York, attending a college noted for its conduit funds, for funding past overthrow of other governments. That's the profile of Andrew Topping. They described him as brilliant. The people who just a few people were interviewed who knew him, or the people who arrested him and around him, brilliant and articulate. Now, in the article, and we're going to talk about them for about 5 minutes, the article, The Realist, on the assassins, I describe the people who hire these assassins and plan them as being brilliant. And one of the troubles with people expecting a conspiracy theory is that they think these must be a bunch of fools who bungle things, and if there were conspiracies, we'd all know because they bungle. You're wrong. They work night and day. And I use the adjective in my article, brilliant. And I think they're brilliant. And this man was described as brilliant and articulate. And he knows what he wants. So taking the two articles on Andrew Topping and breaking down, you see how I do the
work? A lot of questions unanswered.
Yeah. You see, doesn't it make a question, considering the climate now, or the allegation that Nixon would be killed, or the charges I made on how Agnew got into power, can you see why those two articles concerned me this week?
Sure.
And I broke them down.
Let's do now, something before you get get a chance to wander off into who knows where. Let's do this, and let's warn people. For the people who have been wanting to subscribe to The Realist, and they have been not able to get the address down quickly enough, get a pen or a pencil if you don't have one now, and in 15 seconds, I'm going to read you the address for subscriptions to The Realist and the Conspiracy Newsletters, both the same.
Right? Yeah. If they miss it, they can call the station, too.
Yeah. But here it comes, so get ready. Don't say we didn't warn you. For The Realist, it is Box 379, Stuyvesant Station, Stuyvesant Station, New York, New York, 10009. I'll give it to you again, so you verify what you have on the paper. The Realist, Box 379, Stuyvesant Station, New York, New York, 10009. 9.
Tell them what's in the Realist now.
Well, what's in the Realist this month is a lot of what you've heard.
Well, there's a three-part article
by Mae Russell on why Martha Mitchell was kidnapped. And what are the other two articles here? Actually, how Nixon actually got into power.
It's a three-part. The title is a little deceiving on the Martha Mitchell. It's the entire background of the Watergate arrest, and it's a good handbook. Paul, you know, is a great satirist, and he sees the funny thing of these articles. He also sees the serious part. That's why he published all this. But he sees the humorous part, and he called the lead article "Why Martha Mitchell Was Kidnapped." But outside of that, it's a very serious article. And if you get this copy and you read it, you'll understand the background of the Watergate affair. Because this Sunday on Issues and Answers, George McGovern said on the television, this last Sunday, everywhere I go, everywhere I speak, every time I have a chance to talk, I'm going to refer to the Watergate affair. And that's important when a man is also pushing in the news Vietnam and the economy. He doesn't intend to speak once without talking about the Watergate tale. And if you want to see the Democrats have a chance to win this election, this is your secret weapon. Get informed and function. And then the middle article in there is the creation of the assassin, how you cover the real assassin by creating a false motive for the actual patsy that's arrested at the time the gun goes off, and that relates to the story we did today.
Okay, now, let me mention about The Realist, too, that subscribing to The Realist, which comes out every other month, is $3 a year, and subscribing to Conspiracy Newsletter, which May will be starting, comes out every other week.
Yeah.
Grueling schedule.
We haven't started it yet because the news is coming in too fast.
But it's $6 a year.
So. But if you subscribe to The Realist, you'll get the conspiracy newsletters until the other starts going. We'll put them all in there. And then there's a little box in there to order.
Yeah, it's inside The Realist. Yeah.
For $3, you can order 10 copies and sell them to your friends or pass them out and get donations and do a chain letter thing for every copy you have.
That's for the copies of this particular issue, the August 72 issue of The Realist. So there's the address. Let me go one more time. It's Box 379, Stuyvesant Station, New York, New York, 10009 for The Realist. So for the people who have been writing saying you do it too fast, we did it slow and several times.
Oh, there's some copies here at the KLRB if they want to pick them up.
If you can come by the studios, station isn't open during the weekend right now, but Monday morning there are some, I think, about 10 copies, 9 or 10 copies
of
The Realist.
I'll bring more if we have an interest.
Anybody who wants to pick one up, come by the station located on Dolores Street between 7th and 8th above the Carmel Pine Cone newspaper. And if you want to leave something for them, fine. If you can't afford it, but you definitely want to read it, fine. Pick it up. It's yours. And circulate it around. Get it read.
And order 10 more.
And order 10 more.
Okay, that's your homework.
I think we're out of time today.
I hope the hour goes as fast for them as it does for me. I always bring in more material than we have time to discuss.
Yes, we'll have to tell the pickup truck to turn around and go back home. Until next week. Okay. That's Dialogue Conspiracy for this Saturday. Hope you'll join us next week. This has been Dialogue Conspiracy, a public affairs presentation of KLRB News. If you have questions that you want answered on future programs, or any comments, write Dialogue Conspiracy, KLRB, Box 3904, Carmel, California, 93921. I'm Phil Kogan.